It's The Wonky Show. Labour conference is next week and Universities UK has been piling on the pressure for some funding relief. We'll get across what we know about its blueprint. We're talking workload, there's some hidden history and another provider, a shut up shop. Is this the trickle before the flood? It's all coming up.
And you know, and honestly, I don't really think that saying we need to uprate the maintenance loan and restore grants really addresses that in a meaningful way. I think so.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to remove all prohibited items from their bag, as usual, three terrific guests. In Manchester, Ben Ward is chief exec at the University of Manchester Students' Union. Ben, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week actually is the whole week. It's welcome week for us. So just the brand new beginnings, a sense of renewal, all the possibility that you see with new students coming back to campus.
Touch of freshest flu as well by the sound of it, Ben.
I'm afraid so.
Oh dear. And in Victoria in London this week, Meg Price is senior policy manager at Public First. Meg, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week, apart from my wonky podcast debut, would be that my colleagues have released a report for Teach First on teacher recruitment and retention this week, which was absolutely lovely to see. So I was at the launch for that last night, which was lovely. So yeah,
there we go, link to that in the show notes. And in Maryport in Cumbria this week, Debbie McVitie is editor at Wonky. Debbie, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, obviously all the fell walking I've been doing from here in Cumbria has been a major highlight, but last night I had the opportunity to speak at a leaders event set up by our partners Mills and Reeve. We're talking about the future of the sector and the challenges for leaders with an absolutely cracking panel of Viv Stern and Chris Husbands. And so I felt very privileged to be part of that.
So yes, we start this week with fees and funding. Universities UK has been dribbling out bits of its blueprint to broadsheets this week, and we've been piecing it all together, haven't we, Debbie?
Yep, well, Labour Party conference kicks off on Sunday, and we know that Universities UK has been working very hard over the summer on its blueprint for higher education policy to try and set out a direction of travel for the new government. We're expecting that full report to be published sometime in the week ahead, exact date TBC. But over this week, in the lead up to the conference, UUK has been kind of slipping out and showing different media outlets different bits of its blueprint. And inevitably, there's been a really big focus on higher education funding and finances. So it's looking like Universities UK is planning on calling for fees to be indexed to inflation, for additional investment in public funding for teaching, for things to be done around funding for science, research and innovation. And in The Guardian, there's been coverage of what seems to be proposals about creating a more managed and sustainable approach to international student recruitment. So yes, we don't have the full picture here. I think what's worth keeping in mind is that because the public debate is always going to be about fees and finance, that's what the media outlets care about. That's what the public understands about higher education. I think we should expect and prepare for the policy analysis in the document when it comes out to be a lot more wide ranging. Because I think the bigger goal here isn't as Viv, the chief executive of Universities UK, would say herself, this is not an ask for funding wrapped in 140 pages of policy analysis. The intention is to try and set up a new compact between universities and government, try and kind of set out an ambitious plan for how universities can be part of the government's agenda for growth, opportunity, and funding is very much an important part of that, but it is only one small part. So we will have to wait for the field report to understand that kind of bigger picture.
Fascinating. Now, Meg, next week, obviously, it looks like Rachel Reeves is preparing us for kind of austerity that isn't austerity in the budget. But then there's also signs this week that they've clocked that being really bloody miserable about everything all of the time won't work. So they've got to point us to the sunlit uplands. Now, that kind of survive and thrive thing, how on earth do they explain that in the context of an incredibly complex higher education funding and system kind of snafu that they're in the middle of?
I mean, I think it's really important that you've raised Rachel Reeves, because obviously that's a really kind of big pressure on DfE, particularly on Bridget Phillipson and some of the decisions that she'll have to make around this. And actually kind of looking at some of the asks that UUK are going to come out with, even the bare minimum will be a huge kind of lift for Bridget Phillipson to try and get through. So actually next week, I think that the change in rhetoric will be something that we'll have to keep an eye on in terms of whether higher education and whether its kind of ability to contribute to the missions that Labour have set out is kind of believed, and that actually whether the UK's case is made kind of good enough, and that maybe it might make them kind of a more attractive option for some of this money and for some of the decisions that they'll have to make. But we will see when the full report comes out. So yeah, as we say, only drips and drabs so far.
Yes, I guess, Ben, it's difficult to see how, you know, the report will fit into wherever Labour have got to on the rhetoric next week, isn't it? But you know, on the ground, not obviously not just at Manchester, but right around the country, things are really starting to get quite crunchy, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. I mean, you know, around 50% of universities are having to make really difficult staffing and course closure decisions at the moment. You know, we're seeing it in bits of the sector that we wouldn't expect to see. But of course, students themselves are still hurting as well. You know, and I think, you know, one of the underreported parts of this is around what happens to the maintenance system. Because, you know, students are struggling with their cost of living, to be told that, you know, the focus is on fees yet again, is going to be difficult to swallow.
Debbie, one of the things that I think is kind of interesting is, we seem to have kind of reached a new level of sort of admitting there's a problem. You know, in the past, it always used to be, well, if, you know, you don't fix finance, there'll be a problem in the future. And given we're still trying to recruit internationally, that might present a problem, mightn't it?
I think some of this is about, I mean, Universities UK is having to kind of manage a really kind of, I guess, complex politics, and I guess, you know, we're talking about 140 odd vice chancellors, all who have a different understanding of kind of how to navigate those politics. So I think there is, I think, the intention is to try and strike a balance between being, and this, you know, and this is partly, I think, possible because there is a new government in Westminster and because of that shift in rhetoric that says, you know, we want to try and work in partnership with universities. I think it would have been very hard previously for universities to kind of sort of say what they've been saying, or what we've seen this week around funding. So there does have to be a kind of, I guess, an honesty about the real implications of the funding crisis. I think perhaps there's still a bit of as you say, the focus is perhaps a bit less on the student experience and about the real implications of constrained funding for choices that are made about resources that are made available to students and class size and all the rest of it. I mean that argument just has to be made. But yes, I think, yeah, there is inevitably also a kind of a wider impact in terms of international recruitment. I think that, you know, the hope is to get to the point, be able to say, look, there's still a great deal of quality in the UK system. This is not about saying, you know, it is miserable. But ultimately, the system needs to get to a point where being kind of, you know, dependent on international student income in a sort of panicked way isn't really good for international students. It isn't really good for universities. So I guess at some point it becomes more important to talk about the slightly sort of difficult realities in funding than it is to continue to kind of keep those recruitment flowing. But of course, it does inevitably end up with sort of, on the one hand, you've got universities saying, come to the UK, it's marvelous. And on the other hand, we're very, very poor. And we're not able to deliver the student experience we would like to. And I guess that's just a kind of two things are true problem that, you know, you sort of have to do both and sort of see where the chips fall on the other side.
Now, Meg, you know quite a bit about, you know, you hang out with people that do, you know, you do polling, don't you, at Public First? You're one of these people that seems to be able to read the minds of Britain. And, you know, on the assumption that maybe there's, you know, some sort of short-term set of fixes just to provide a bit of relief, pending a longer review coming. If Rachel Reeves was trying to pay for that notionally, one of the things that I've written about on the site this week is that, of course, what the last government did was give a massive tax cut to rich graduate men in their 50s by getting rid of interest rates. Now, the problem with that is we also know that interest rates are incredibly unpopular on student loans. So, you know, some of the options, if Rachel Reeves tries to notionally balance the books, are really tricky, aren't they?
Well, actually, it's really interesting. So we did a report on public attitudes to tuition fees this time last year. And what we found was really interesting of that, because of the complexity of tuition fees, people in the abstract really supported. We obviously looked at it through a lens of abolition because that was something that Keir Starmer was committed to a long, long time ago. But actually, people were kind of committed to, were supportive of that in the abstract. But when you talk to people about how things are paid for, they become increasingly kind of sketchy about things like abolition of tuition fees and things like that. Having said that, people's appetite for tuition fees going up in terms of to support universities is not there as well. That's incredibly unpopular. It came out in our research that the most popular kind of tuition fee level was around 6,500, which would obviously not be kind of viable in this context. But this is something that kind of, you know, Bridget Phillips is really going to have to tackle with the kind of public perceptions and public receipt of any changes that she'll make, alongside the fight that she'll be having with the Treasury about money and things like that, and kind of managing the field of universities knocking at her door saying, we ran out of money. But yeah, it's all very complicated. But with the public, I think it might even raise, as these conversations go on, it might even raise some, you know, conversations that we've had in the past around things like VC pay, value for money for students and things like that. And that's something that I think the sector have really got to be prepared for.
Ben, obviously, one of the things, you know, we were around the last time a big funding blueprint was published by NUS about 15 years ago for a graduate tax. But, one of the really interesting questions, I think, is, you know, to get economic growth, you definitely want new graduates, ambitious graduates, kind of moving around the country, getting jobs, you know, doing all that sort of stuff. But of course, if they hold the repayment threshold down, that's really tricky for a party that is perhaps a little bit more focused on the under 55s than its predecessor. Now, you know, I guess most people in the sector don't think that much about the graduate repayment picture, but my sense is it matters quite a bit.
Yes, it matters a lot, but that's partly because of the sector's obsession with the sticker price in the first place, and you know, the unit of resource going into universities. I think there's very little thought and very little modelling of what that looks like over someone's career. And there's clearly more work to do on that. You know, the fiddling around the edges, you know, from Osborne onwards, you know, with the repayment threshold, length of times, salary rates, you know, very little coverage, you know, has affected, you know, wider public perceptions of how universities are funded. There is still an obsession, you know, as we talked about back in 2009, 2010, on the, you know, the sticker price paid in the first place, rather than what that looks like, you know, whether there's, you know, you could do something with the upper rates of income tax, you know, and so on and so on.
Debbie, if you sort of put all this together, I guess one of the other messages that has come out this week in terms of bits that have, you know, these kind of bits that we think are going to come in this big blueprint is a sort of something for something thing. Now, there was one kind of fairly unfortunate bit of coverage, I think, about international students. But I guess the other was the magic wand of efficiencies. Is it possible to wave a magic wand and, you know, five universities share a campus?
Well, I mean, one of the things I can say is that it is astonishing how much this is a live conversation in a way that it really just wasn't 3 years ago. And I think we should also, I think, be quite clear that the efficiencies is a word that's kind of doing quite a lot of work. What is not being talked about, although it is also inevitable that this is what is happening in universities, are the sort of efficiency savings that mean that, you know, you've got staffing freezes, you've got kind of sort of restructures that mean that essentially people are having to do more with less. You know, that's all going on right now. But the sorts of efficiencies that are being talked about and that have been talked about in the past, but then I think one of the things that happened was the sort of settlement of the 2010s made it much less of a pressing need to do. Are things like sharing services, you know, harmonising processes so that there can be, you know, a sort of shared underpinning infrastructure, possibly more collaborative provision share, you know, things like sharing campuses. It is safe to say that one of the reasons these things have not happened in the past is that they are really, really difficult to do. They definitely do not realise cost savings, mostly in the first instance. And it is not always clear what the overall outcome and intention is. I think one of the kind of my takeaways from the conversation so far, and we're working on this with a number of different organisations, a number of different ways, is really, really thinking about, not about, you know, how do we save money in the here and now, because actually, and I think this is where efficiencies is actually a terrible word, because that's not really what we're talking about. What we're talking about is realising new forms of value for the future, and trying to do things differently in a way that kind of actually generates, you know, finding sort of common goals and agendas, perhaps around access, perhaps around different kind of delivery of different bits of the portfolio, perhaps around research and the kind of sharing of of kit and that sort of thing, or making available, you know, making things available to communities, lots of different ways of thinking about this that will have value, that ultimately could realize savings deliver things in a better way. And being prepared to start putting in the infrastructure in place now to deliver that. But that, you know, often it is expensive. I mean, one of the things that is often talked about is, for example, why is it that there are, you know, multiple different student record systems when ultimately the process of registering students is the same in every institution? Why can't we just have one big system that the whole sector shares and it's all there? And then we've got this enormous data pool, and then actually the data can be pulled out. And that actually would be quite efficient, right? Rather than having lots and lots of people kind of gathering data and then giving data back to a central place. But it requires people to talk. It requires funding and you know, and will and investment. It requires people to have the kind of capacity, the capability to do that sort of work. And it requires things to kind of carry on working for a very long time, for the regulatory framework to be kind of, to make those things possible. So the reason, you could legitimately say, we've been talking about this for years and it's never happened and all that. And I think that's quite legitimate. And the reason is because it's really, really hard. But there might be a prize on offer. And I think there's quite a lot of appetite to try and understand that a bit better. And I think that's one of the things Universities UK will be kind of committing to.
And actually, if you look at, you know, other big monolithic systems, you know, such as the NHS, we don't really have a good track record in delivering such things, do we? The only other thing I was going to say on this is some of this stuff is hard inside universities, let alone between universities. When it comes to sharing and collaborating and standardizing processes and infrastructure within an institution is hard enough without trying to mold institutional cultures between universities and so on. I think this is really, really tough. But there are things that we could do. And thinking about my own sector, you know, one of the things, you know, it's got to be the case that we've got to be better as student unions in leading the way on sharing and collaborating. And there are really good models for that, of course, elsewhere in Europe.
Yeah. Either, I guess, with the university or with other student unions in Manchester, in your case, or in other parts of the country. Yeah. Meg, Sam Friedman, who will be at our festival, as will many others. Sam Friedman's got a classic cracking post up today on his Comment His Feed blog on the efficiency paradox. And without kind of, you know, reading it out, it's the old, do you know what? If you want to make the NHS more efficient, you have a number of high quality specialist providers for, you know, particular types of operation. But on the other hand, no one wants their local hospital to close. Now, whenever there have been efficiency drives in higher education, there tends to be a loss of campuses. And, this idea that you'll kind of lose things when you become more efficient is really, really hard for governments, let alone universities, to escape, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just thinking about what Ben was saying a minute ago, I do think the elephant in the room when we have these conversations is around autonomy, and about how institutions see where the drivers for this is coming from. You know, as the heat turns up on the pressure cooker of the financial instability of the sector, what can be done and where is this kind of direction coming from in terms of who's going to say what these systems are, or who's going to push people to kind of concentrate on one thing first? And I think there are roles for people like UUK, but also there is a thing about kind of where are the trade-offs in terms of, you know, where does this leadership need to come from? Is this kind of, you know, something that universities are saying, right, okay, we have a really big problem with this as a collective sector and we need to learn from another sector, or, you know, we need to get help in general. This is probably really bad for consultants, but realistically, universities are getting consultants in on individual level for each institution. But what can be done kind of like the sector as a whole? Because my colleagues, Jonathan Simons and Jess Lister, wrote a report recently called Institution Overboard for the University of Warwick, which looked at kind of, and I'll go on to this a little bit later on when we talk about provider closure, but basically about how you support people to transform. And actually, if institutions can't do them themselves, where is this money coming from? Where is this expertise coming from? And how can, you know, institutions be supported to be proactive about this as well?
Debbie, if, there's obviously quite a bit of public debate right now about private schools and VAT on private schools. But, you know, if you have been putting your kids through private school at 20 grand a year for a day pupil. And then you manage to get them into the Russell Group, into this kind of hyper-efficient bearing down on costs environment. They're still going to, you know, do really well in the labour market. And the university years are a bloody bargain at that point, aren't they? Soak the rich.
I don't know what to say. Sure. Yes, I agree. You're right, Jim. Let's do that. No, I think that one of the things that I think often that does get lost here is about the way that really realizing the value of the opportunity to study at a university it remains true that you do need to have some capital to mobilize to do that. So if you come from a middle class background and you've got parental support, you can do stuff. The quality of the teaching and learning is one thing, and the availability of contact hours and academic support and all the rest of it. But also all the things that you might do around internships and volunteering and all the cool stuff that is a traditional university experience. A lot of that is just not available to you if you have to work, if you don't have a lot of money and all the rest of it, or your opportunity is reduced. Then that has an impact on your outcomes. I think there's And honestly, I don't really think that saying we need to upgrade the maintenance loan and restore grants really addresses that in a meaningful way. I think there's a kind of the fact that the question about how kind of I guess universities realize value for students, the focus of thinking about efficiencies and what cost it, a lot of this is about kind of going back and saying, where is the value here? It's absolutely in knowledge. It's absolutely in kind of exposure to, cutting edge research and that sort of thing. But it's also in the experience and the connections. So what do we absolutely need to preserve? And what does that look like in this new environment? Actually, is there stuff that we could deliver more efficiently that we've really prioritized before, but actually on reflection isn't as important, because it's much more important that students get to be together in rooms and connect with each other and kind of grapple with interesting kind of real world problems than it is that they get access to physical books or there's judgments will have to be made. And I think what is particularly important, I think, for the Russell Group to think about is that just because that there's a particular version of a university experience that is very middle class coded and is quite sort of elite and is kind of thought of culturally as being kind of the gold standard, that doesn't necessarily mean it's the best thing for all students.
Look, Meg, the thing that strikes me is, on the one hand, almost inevitably, but perhaps realistically, there's a drive here to make university spending more efficient. But on the other hand, it does feel like both the staff experience, and we'll come on to this later, and crucially the student experience is now so efficient, so stacked up with part-time work and long commutes and caring responsibilities and juggling deadlines and so on and so on, that we could do with actually the staff and student experience being a bit less efficient.
Really, we're looking at short-term problem, but then there's also a long-term problem here as well. Short term, you're looking at kind of students' expectations about what they're receiving and how that kind of compares to other parts of their lives, including their schooling, but also kind of other things that are on offer to them, right? You've got private education providers that are kind of excelling in terms of innovating the way that they're teaching and learning, and obviously can move a lot quicker than large institutions. So that's something that is kind of, really something that people who are looking at going into university will be looking at. Like, realistically, those are some of their options. But I also think long term as well, and I feel like this is future stuff, but actually, and I know that the sector is going through a real big kind of existential crisis at the moment, but this is something that they really need to look at as they come out of this, is about kind of the change in demographics that we're going to experience in the UK. And what that means for kind of skills matching with different jobs, and about how people will have to start changing jobs to kind of fit growing occupations and leave declining occupations. And actually, this is somewhere where institutions could give real value to the economy and to the government. But what they offer and the student experience and how that's delivered through, staff experience needs to change, because it's not the same as it's always been. And, actually, that will be a really big challenge for the sector moving forward. And it's something that I think really has to be on people's minds personally.
Now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Fiona McBride, Senior Research Developer for Prosper at the University of Liverpool. This week on Wonky, we've been blogging about the central role principal investigators play in fostering a positive and inclusive research culture, the way in which they're increasingly being asked to take on complex people management responsibilities, and what higher education institutions can do to engage and support them in this role, given how time-pressed they are with their primary research responsibilities. I talk about how higher education institutions need to ensure they tailor resources to the unique nature of the PI role, addressing the distinct pressures they face and context they work in. I also talk about HEIs need to emphasise the benefits of people management to PIs themselves, how it can improve team productivity, boost their own career prospects, and lead to greater funding opportunities down the line. Most critically of all, I talk about the importance of community, of cultivating spaces where PIs can engage in peer learning. This is something we're doing at Prosper via our PI network, a free-to-access cross-institutional forum open to PIs across the UK, where they can connect, learn from each other, and share best practice.
Now, next up, the Advanced Business Academy suddenly closed down this week. Ben, what's going on there?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's linked, I think, probably to our previous story about, you know, whether this is the canary in the coal mine for what else might be happening in the sector. So the Advanced British Academy, it was on the OFS register of approved franchise and partnership provision, campuses in London and Luton, mainly business degrees, and 300 current and prospective students are affected by its what looks like a sudden closure, but actually it's been investigated for the past few months by the Office for Students, and the DfE has ceased payment of tuition fees during the course of the investigation. So whilst that was going on, even more financial pressure placed on the institution. Now, it will be interesting to see, I think, when the mop-up of this happens, you know, what were the student protection plans in place for the two provider institutions, the University of Buckingham and Leeds Trinity University?
Now, Debbie, I've been on to OFS and had some answers whilst we've been recording this morning. And I guess one of the interesting things in the announcement and in the email I've had this morning is that OFS says, as you know, the Department for Education instructed the Student Loans Company to suspend all tuition fee payments to ABA until OFS completed its investigation. Now, reading between the lines here, we obviously don't know what has happened, but it must be really hard for a franchise provider like that to remain a going concern if it's not getting any tuition fees in.
Yes, and the original investigation was not on the presumption of wrongdoing, wasn't it? We just have no idea what's going on, do we? Because, you know, did they close because they knew that there was going to be something uncovered that would have kind of knocked them over anyway, or have they just been victims of some very kind of not perhaps very well thought through policymaking, or indeed actually is what we're seeing the sort of inevitable kind of consequence of just a sort of structural artifact? Because it would be very difficult, I think, for DfE to continue to pump public money into an organisation that had been flagged as needing an investigation. That sort of seems like the sort of thing that would be sort of seen as problematic in the first place. So I think there may just be something to unravel there in terms of the kind of process and consequence. And of course we shouldn't know. But Ben mentioned the student protection plans, and there is, I think, having looked at both of them, there is a commitment from both institutions to sort of seek and find alternatives for the students. I think they're actually quite interesting to compare. I don't know if you want to get onto that, but in terms of what they've articulated, one thing is very important that in both that the collaborative provision is very much kind of part of that. So it's not just, you know, it has been assessed as part of that kind of risk matrix in student protection, and provider closure or provider failure of a franchise partner is very much in there. But I think it really does remain to be seen whether the sorts of alternatives that will be on offer will be adequate, acceptable, palatable to the students concerned. Because particularly when you're talking about providers of business courses in London, clearly there's lots of other options in that space. But there's no guarantee that you can kind of set someone up in there. Often the sorts of students who take those sorts of courses tend to be quite tied to their locality. So I don't think it's very possible that they're going to be able to kind of travel up to Leeds and the University of Buckingham. So I think there is going to be something quite important there about the nature of the alternative that is provided. And at this point, all that the universities can undertake to do is to offer alternatives. And the council would say, well, we guarantee that this will be the right thing for every student, because that's just not something that they can guarantee.
What strikes me in this though, Meg, right, is there's real moral hazard here. So if you're inside DfE, I can see why you might say to yourself, while this investigation's on, we're not going to hand over, you know, underwritten student loans, public money. But on the other hand, if it's the not handing over of the public money that has caused the provider to fall over, there's a kind of real moral hazard here, isn't there? Because it could be, you know, let's imagine, it could well be that the investigation finds nothing wrong, and that what has happened as a result is a provider has fallen over and 300 students are suddenly messed around right at the start of the year. Now, you know, at a macro level, we might regard that as, you know, a sort of unfortunate casualty. But I mean, if this is then a pattern around some of the other places that must be being looked at, given that wider report on franchising, what do you do if you're DfE stroke OFS to both protect students but still safeguard their quality and the money?
I mean, DfE have their own rules and will have had a kind of like a really strong conversation internally about why they've done this the way they have. But I think, like you said, it kind of represents a wider problem of, you know, at the moment with the way the sector is, this is currently a really big problem, obviously, for 300 current and prospective students at this institution, right? But just imagine if there is then a bigger problem of, you know, as we go through this sort of like period of change, if there's more students at risk and this becomes a bigger problem for DfE in terms of being able to kind of like not just understand what's happening with different institutions and whether they should withdraw their kind of tuition fees and withhold them. But then at a higher scale, there's bigger pressure on DfE to do that. But also, how are they supposed to kind of, you know, support these institutions and these students? And I just want to kind of pick a point on student protection plans. I think it was mentioned in a report that was released recently with Warwick that I mentioned earlier about how inadequate they are for protecting students, both legally and in a practical sense as well. And actually, I think that's something that the sector really need to look at in terms of if they really are prioritizing students and their student experience, how do they support them when probably one of the most disruptive things that could happen to their education does happen? Because at the moment, I really don't think it's at a level that the sector should be kind of, you know, accepting. And actually, it's something that they should be really proactive about of, you know, protecting these students and ensuring that they have viable options.
I wonder, is there something about pace here? Because I think, is there a kind of tolerance band for the scale of, you know, because obviously you want to do it. If you're doing an in-depth investigation of something that is of a concern, then obviously you want to make sure you've done all the paperwork, you've dotted your I's, you've crossed your T's. But it's also, I think, perhaps unrealistic to expect an institution to continue to, you know, to function without funds while the kind of full thing is going on. Is there a kind of tolerance for a period where a rapid investigation finds that there is something that warrants further, you know, that warrants the full fat version? Do we need to be, you know, do we need to just be a bit more sophisticated about how these things are managed? Because I think, you know, we are used to operating in a sector in which things are done at a leisurely pace, and there is, you know, and done very comprehensively and with deep sort of thought and reflection. That may not be the world that we live in when we're dealing with small agile providers that perhaps, you know, that are operating perhaps on a different kind of business model and all the rest of it. Maybe just the process needs to be tweaked.
But look, I mean, I guess on the one hand, that's a really important question. To some extent, it relates to when these things kick off during an academic year, right? But on the other hand, if it turns out that on one level or another, something like this was inevitable, you do go back to the question of why has it happened in the first place? Was the set of circumstances that led to this worth the risk in terms of those students being able to enroll on those programs at that institution in London? And, you know, there's a question, isn't there, about all the risk balance. But Ben, the other thing that strikes me is, I don't want to reduce all of this to, you know, getting a flight, but obviously, if your flight's cancelled, what you really want is to be put on the next flight. But on the other hand, once you're there, you also want some compensation, don't you? Now, it's really, really unclear to me who, if anyone, will compensate these students, because it doesn't feel like the actual business academy is going to be able to, although, you know, I may be wrong here. And it doesn't also feel like the two institutions, one that franchises, one that validates, are necessarily on the legal hook. I just don't know, actually.
No, well, one of the things that has interested me about our whole conversation so far is how little we've talked about the two institutions. You know, yes, there is a regulator, You know, there are, you know, all sorts of actors in this. But really, for me, the hands-on regulator needs to be the universities that are accrediting or franchising the courses. And, you know, they are not equipped. They are clearly not doing the right due diligence on all of these partnerships. And it is scandalous. And, you know, really, if universities are willing and able to use their name to support these institutions, you know, my view is that those institutions need to be held responsible for supporting students to get a new flight, as you've put it, but also that there's compensation in place. And would that mean that universities are more careful about who they partner with?
Now, we should say, obviously, for legal reasons, that it may well be that the two universities in this case have done lots and lots of really Indeed. Important due diligence and so on, and some things have gone wrong. But I guess to some extent, you know, all of that will come out in the...
But it's a broader point about the model, though, isn't it? That, you know, what types of due diligence, both privately and publicly through student protection plans, are institutions doing before they enter partnerships with these? The final thing I wanted to say on this, I was really interested in some of the links that you put out about this a few days ago in relation to the behaviour of agents and how they are describing life at this institution that I think bears very little resemblance to what's ended up happening with the academy.
And Debbie, we're still waiting, aren't we, for the results of this DfE investigation into agents that was supposed to look at both international agents off the back of that Sunday Times stuff earlier on in the year and the antics of domestic agents.
Yes, well, I imagine some of that is pending, you know, a sort of broader understanding of what the direction of travel is of the new government, and you know, yeah. You know, these things will be kind of underway, and then it's just where that fits in the wider kind of policy agenda.
Well, look, plenty more on the site about all of this, and there's obviously plenty still to come on all of this. For now, every week this season, we're having a think about how things were and how things came to be with City St George's Academic Registrar Mike Ratcliffe. Here's the hidden history of HE.
One of the interesting things, if you think about the development of the English higher education sector, is how come the Scots, by the end of the 16th century, have five universities and the English only have two. Aberdeen has as many universities as England has. So why does this? We end up in this very strange situation? Well, one of those key reasons is that Oxford and Cambridge get quite comfortable being universities, and they are very good at patronising the king and getting the king to stop other universities. So there are two key examples of where the established universities kill off the opposition that they have. So the first of these is the University of Northampton. So Northampton, which now has a perfectly nice university, doesn't have any lecture theatres, but it has a perfectly nice university. And its original university in the city was founded way back time of Henry III, and it's another offshoot. So problems at Oxford, some of the students get up and go, they coalesce in Northampton. But the problem is that this is a time of civil war, and so the students there, although the university gets going, they pick the wrong side. So they pick Simon de Montfort's rebels. And so when the King's army comes near Northampton, they use their arrows and bows, or their bows and arrows even, to fire on the King's troops. So this doesn't endear the King to the students of Northampton, because they're clearly rebellious and they don't like him. But meanwhile, the University of Oxford has decided, well, it's not very keen on Northampton. It's a bit close in terms of its monopoly. And it petitions the King to say, can we have this place stopped? Because it will harm our city of Oxford. And he gets the bishops on his side, and therefore the King has a writ, and the University of Northampton is dissolved and got rid of. And the other attempt comes in Stamford in Lincolnshire, which sadly doesn't have a university to this day, a fine FE college, but no university. And it gets another offshoot university. A group of rebellious scholars get up and go. Migration is a technique used all over Europe to found new universities. So they migrate and off they go. But again, there's a petition from the two existing universities to have it stopped. And so they get the king to issue another writ. And what's fun in its kind of scheme of things, is that Oxford inserts a clause into the oath that you swear to become a master. When you take your Master of Arts degree, you swear an oath. You uphold the statutes of the university, but you also uphold an oath never to teach at Stanford. So in the oath that they then continue to swear for the next 500 years, everyone is absolutely saying that you only teach at Oxford and Cambridge and never at Stanford. So they have to get rid of this clause in the beginning of the 19th century, because actually some people say, well, I can't teach at UCL. What becomes UCL? Because I swear on this oath that I can't possibly do this anymore. Oh, that's wildly out of date. So Oxford and Cambridge do their best to get rid of other university. The Scots have a much more sensible system, because I think there's a whole range of different factors, but travel is more complex, but they also see the value of having universities in different places. So different kings found, I mean, effectively tiny universities, but they have much more of a local feel. So students from the locale go to that university. They don't build halls of residence. People stay much more locally linked. And so by the time they get to the University of Edinburgh being founded, it's a town university. It's a sense that the town wants to have a university, and it gets a royal charter to do so. But it's about creating them. So because Aberdeen ends up being reformed by them setting up a different college. So there's King's College and there's Marshall College. They set up a different college in the same city. And so Aberdeen officially has two universities until they're united in the 19th century. Hence, the Aberdeen has as many universities as England has anonymously. So we get into a kind of a weird situation in terms of suppressing competition.
Now, finally this week, industrial relations issues rumble on, and there's actually various people thinking about workload, Meg.
So last week brought an updated final offer on pay and conditions from the University College's Employers Association. So after long and intensive negotiations with the five campus unions, it's not shifted the headline pay increase on offer. But this week, UCU recognised that part of the employer's offer related to working conditions, so pay spine review, quality pay gaps, casualisation and workload, has a lot to recommend, leaving the union in a complicated spot about how to move forward. There's been lots of articles on Wonky this week about lots of different parts of this, including workload, so things on staff burnout and expectations on working hours too.
Now, Debbie, I thought Joe Grady's update to members ahead of internal meetings at UCU in the coming week was very interesting. One of the things I can't quite read though is, given there's all this talk about efficiencies, but given there's been a long-standing kind of set of concerns about workload, is the activity in this area sort of offensive in terms of trying to kind of sort out the problem? Or is this a defensive move? Because one of the things that might happen when you make places more efficient is people just get dumped with more things to do.
I think it is safe to say that there is very widespread concern about, morale, I think, is a sort of broad concern. It is very gloomy out there. I think a lot of people are very worried about the future of the sector. They're very worried for their own jobs. They're facing very difficult circumstances, whether it is trying to do more with less in their own context, or whether it is, being at risk of redundancy or sort of structural change, or having to do things kind of differently. All of those things are really, really tough. I think that the talking about workload and pay spine and equality of pay are things that UCU has been asking for and frankly UCU has been offering to work with UCU for a very long time, because these are long-standing challenges in higher education. I think that they are much more pressing challenges now because as you say, universities don't have a lot of money. And I think that there's something quite important about, and obviously the trade union, the function of the trade union is to campaign for improved terms and conditions for staff. But that kind of broader kind of staff experience piece, what's it like to work in a university, is one that needs, it feels like there's a sort of tipping point here where it can't just be, but we've got to do more and more and more and more and more. It's got to be about saying, well, actually, if we're talking about efficiencies, what does it, what relief might be brought deploying things in a different way and looking at our processes, some of the kind of habits and cultural habits that universities have about responding to students, about the management of processes and the kind of gold plating of processes. I think the sense from staff that their autonomy and their kind of professional decision making is increasingly constrained, and or that there is a culture where they are just expected to kind of do the job, whether or not that is, you know that they're being put under pressure, and in some cases I think put under some quite really negative pressure to do it. One of the pieces that we had on the site was from referring to some research that's been published looking at the phenomenon of burnout among professional services staff, and some of this is about a culture, you know, high performance culture in which we all kind of say, oh, I'm so busy this week and there's just so much going on, and there's a little bit of kind of, you know, you do it to yourself. But there is also, I think, evidence that in some places this is very much about a lack of investment in leadership at every level of the institution, causing people to not manage their staff as well as we might hope, and put them under pressure to do more and deliver in ways that are causing those staff to feel kind of stressed and to have that their autonomy is reduced. So I think, yeah, really complicated picture. I don't think that nothing's been done in the past about this, and I certainly don't think that kind of just saying everyone goes into 35-hour week, you know, lickety split and end of discussion is going to be the answer, because we are talking about high performing autonomous professionals. But if there can be some joint work on this, and that's just fantastic. I think, you know, we all need, post pandemic particularly, we all need to get to grips with how we manage our workload, and what is in our control and what is not. And that is a universal thing. In higher education, it manifests in some quite distinctive ways that we need to understand better.
I mean, Ben, one of the things that does strike me about this is that when either we're offered or when we ourselves find ways to become more efficient with our time, you know, sometimes there are newspaper articles that suggest that one day, I don't know, thanks to AI or thanks to whatever, we'll be able to work 3 days a week. And of course, what really happens is you just become more efficient. The conversation we were having earlier, and I guess that does generate cynicism amongst people. But the other thing, you know, the other thing that really strikes me about this is, what if loads of really, really good work is done on things like, you know, workload models and so on, and we work out that, you know, we really can't afford what we're delivering now. Do you know what I mean? Do you see what I mean? What if we actually sit down and work it out and realise that we're kind of pulling off a miracle, and that, you know, that's kind of, you know, immoral or illegal?
Well, I think in some ways that will happen. I mean, you know, Debbie touched on the pandemic there, and I think maybe what we've seen is just a gradual accumulation of things. You know, there's not been kind of, you know, strategic initiatives to, you know, add things that are delivering value. This stuff has just emerged. And you're right, if we were to go back to square one, would we design the workload model like this? Would we design universities full stop in the way that we have now? Probably not. As a sector, we're really bad at stopping things. So, you know, whenever new technology is launched, actually, it just allows more time for other things rather than saying, let's stop doing this. So I think this is a really complex picture. And I think it's likely that if real work was done on this, it would require a total reinvention of the model. This is where I think something has been lost in the last 10 years around the broader collaboration and collegiality of the sector. I think there's a real opportunity with UUK's blueprint for the future into also start to talk about some of this stuff. You know, what could national organisations, whether they be employers' organisations, bits of university organisations, the trade unions coming together, you know, in some kind of, you know, compact around this stuff. I think it could be really exciting, but it's not going to be solved by just devolving this to UCU and UCEA to thrash it out every year.
I think that all of those points are fantastic and spot on. And I think that actually the main fundamental point is that universities are really, really complicated. And actually with that comes a real like detangling of, I remember being in conversations about workload as a student union officer and about how universities are individually unique, but then within that they have so many kind of different tiers around staffing and approaches to kind of workload delivery. I have no idea what the answer to that is, but it has reminded me of a report that I would recommend that everybody goes and read, because it's a fantastic report. And it's written by Sam Friedman, who was mentioned earlier, and our founding partner, Rachel Wolfe at Public First. And it's about the productivity puzzle of the NHS. And it basically just looks at hospital activity, funding and staffing. And I think it's something that's really important in terms of using examples from other other you know, sectors and other places that have really complicated staffing structures and really complicated delivery models, and how maybe the higher education system could learn from that and apply it, obviously in a different context, but use some of that research to kind of, you know, push things forwards in this space around kind of looking at how workload can be managed and, you know, supporting people to thrive in the work.
I think as well, it's really worth noting as well about how the external environment shapes people's experience of their work. Because I was chatting to a colleague from the Irish HE sector last week, and he was saying, you know, we all the same challenges. You know, funding is a real challenge. There's a deficit in HE funding in Ireland. All the kind of big sort of tech challenges about, you know, curriculum transformation. You know, the sector is really not very dissimilar to what we have. But the difference, he says, is that by and large the government likes higher education. There's a positive conversation going on. It's seen as having a kind of function and a purpose and a role in the nation. And that really makes all the difference, because you can. It is much more possible to tolerate and manage challenges, including the very correct reality that there is just more to do than there are hours in the day, and that is, you know, that is a sort of universal reality, and often choices have to be made, and, you know, being empowered to make those choices is important. But knowing that you're all trying to serve a higher purpose, that you've all got some kind of that what you do is appreciated and recognised and thought of as being important, it's not the solution, but I think it's really really that's something that our sector has not seen to a significant degree, and has really felt, I think, and it comes through in Monkey surveys, particularly our community tell us that, you know, it is just very feeling very ground down by the sense that what our sector does is not valued, and I think that does have an impact as well.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to go in deep on anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Ben, Meg, Debbie, Michael Salmon for making it all happen. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.